The Babylon Project podcast was our last best hope for reruns. It failed. But in the year of the Shadow War, it became something greater. Our last best hope for fandom. The year is 2017. The place, the Babylon Project podcast.
This is Maggie Egan, your ISN news anchor, and you're listening to the Babylon Project podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hello there again, Babylon 5 fans. This is the Babylon Project podcast. This is Raul Ybarra joining you as always with my good friends, Jim Arrowood and JP Harvey. Say hello, gentlemen.
Hey, how you doing?
Hello, everyone.
Oh, if I sound a little off, it was because I botched up the initial recording start, folks, and here we are on Tarai 2. Well, Jim, I'm going to go ahead and ask, but I think I have an idea. What episode are we talking about tonight?
A late delivery from Avalon.
A very, very intensive story. Not a high action story, but it is very intense, and it gives us a lot of good background information.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, too.
That it is. That it is. As you mentioned, it's got a very, very significant stage and screen actor in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a Marcus heavy story.
Yeah, actually, in a lot of ways it is. Michael York's in it, so
yeah.
You it would hardly be a surprise if it didn't throw the Brits together. In a serious manner. I guess probably the best way to get this set up for us is, Jim, do you have a synopsis for us?
Coming right up.
Archive. Access. Initiated.
A man arrives on Babylon 5 claiming to be King Arthur returned from Avalon. The legend says that the mythical character will return when he is most needed, and Arthur believes that he is needed but is not sure what he's needed for. While Dr. Franklin attempts to positively identify the stranger, Arthur escapes Medlab and goes about the station performing good deeds, and he meets Jakar, who helps Arthur as he goes about his chivalrous business. Meanwhile, Franklin manages to positively identify Arthur, who is actually one David McIntyre, a former gunner who fired the first shot during the Earth-Minbari War 15 years earlier. Franklin believes it is his duty to tell McIntyre who he actually is, but Marcus is against that, telling Franklin that it will do more damage than good. When Franklin tells McIntyre the facts, the latter enters a catatonic state after explaining that Excalibur, his sword, must be returned to the Lady of the Lake. Delenn is recruited to fill the Lady of the Lake role and takes the sword from McIntyre, which brings him back to consciousness and cures his delusions. McIntyre leaves the station with a group of Narns who help to organize the resistance against the Centauri. Sheridan is worried about the defense of the station, believing that he cannot rely on the Minbari forever for help. He devises a plan and proposes the League of Non-Aligned Worlds to continue trading on Babylon 5 if they agree to help. Some agree, while others do not. Mr. Garibaldi goes to the station's post office to pick up a package of some of his favorite food items, but learns that it will cost him an excessive amount to pick up the package because of the difficulties involved in moving the mail since Babylon 5 broke away from the Earth Alliance. He refuses to pay and later unsuccessfully attempts to steal the package. Finally, he decides to pay for the shipping, but tells the station's postmaster that he will have to begin paying rent unless he gives Garibaldi a bribe for exactly one credit more than the cost of the postage for the package he received. Well, there it is.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
There it is.
Yeah. So, a King Arthur story.
Yeah, an interesting twist on a King Arthur story.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've kind of let the cat out of the bag as far as who the guest stars are, at least one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go ahead and make that make it official here.
Sure.
Character files opened.
Well, we start off with Michael York as King Arthur / David McIntyre. His only appearance on Babylon 5.
Right.
Probably most known to us geeky type people in Logan's Run as Logan from 1976. And he has credits dating back to 1967. And we would be probably here all night if we went completely through the man's credits. So he's been in a whole lot of stuff in all different kinds of roles.
The other thing I remember him in is Three Musketeers.
Mm-hmm.
Playing D'Artagnan.
Yeah, he was D'Artagnan, the ne'er-do-well fourth musketeer.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, gosh, this is a dumb one. I don't think he ever did. I know he's done a lot of Shakespeare. I mean, that was his real claim to fame as a Shakespearean actor.
Mm-hmm.
His Hamlet is fantastic.
I'd say it's almost as good as his Basil exposition in Austin Powers.
Oh.
Or Basil exposition.
Oh, gosh. Did York ever do Camelot?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't. I as I said, I didn't dig too deep into the credits because it was a huge list.
Yeah. And I know that, I mean, that's, that, you know, Camelot, of course, everyone thinks Richard Harris, obviously.
Yeah.
But I don't know why. For some reason, I have an image of him connected with it.
Mm.
Anyway, who else do we have?
Well, and we have a gentleman named Michael Kagan, who plays Emmett Farquaha. He was the postal worker that I mentioned in the synopsis.
Oh, gosh.
Again, this is his only appearance on Babylon 5, and another appearance he had in Star Trek Voyager.
Uh-huh. There's got to be a story behind the name.
I haven't found it, but...
Good heavens.
Yeah. So that's our guest cast for tonight.
Uh-huh.
Initiating plot analysis.
Like JP noted, this is something of a Marcus story, but it really doesn't start off with that much of that kind of a direction at all. It starts off with Sheridan and Susan kind of worried. The station's open again, as they said last time. Babylon 5 is open for business, but you know, they're not getting Earth funding anymore, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to find some way of increasing the trade revenues and getting some help and protection. So that sets out one side story.
Yep.
And the other side story, how do I put it? You know, forget the Earth Alliance military breaking Babylon 5. They're amateurs. You really want to break someone, drop the bureaucracy of the Postal Service on them. Yeah, Mike's thinking he's going to beat the post office.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah, that never goes well.
He's got a whole big shipment of goodies coming in, and as you noted, they're trying to slap him with the postmaster's trying to slap him with a ridiculous padded price to get it through.
Well, not only does the station need funding, Mike also needs funding.
Yep. And pepperoni.
I wonder if he's trying to put together another Banya Cauda dinner.
Banya Cauda?
Yes.
No idea. You know, one of my wife's friends makes that. And I have got to convince her to make it for us someday.
Ah. Have you ever had that, JP?
I have never had that.
I'll tell you what, the anchovies don't appeal to me.
I'm not a fan of the anchovies, but if it's a dish you can hold those out of, I'd probably enjoy it.
Yeah.
I'm not an anchovy fan, but let's face it, anchovy is a key ingredient for a Caesar salad, for a Caesar dressing.
Ah.
And I love a good Caesar salad.
Well, that's why I order blue cheese.
I'm going to leave it as it's much more of what do they do with it.
Yeah.
But now we turn a little serious because someone is having a bad dream.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say, you know, because I've heard some people talk about how, what kind of connections? Well, we know right here from the beginning that whoever this guy is having some sort of issues.
Yeah, and he finds a sword.
Yep.
Excalibur.
Well, the other piece, and it almost looks like, oh, we've got yet another story segment here. But no, it's not so much that. It connects into this main storyline. We find Franklin and Marcus working together, helping sick lurkers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not going to be the only time we see them linked together like this.
No, and it's pretty funny when they get together.
Oh, gosh, yeah. But you know what? I almost think part of what led to it is what we saw with them here, because there really is a good chemistry between the two actors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're talking like they're old friends, which is neat.
Yeah. And in that conversation, I love it. The way Marcus takes comfort in the unfairness of the universe. But he's asked about his pin, the Ranger pin, and explains it. And I love that comment about the dawn of a new age sort of thing that comes out of the opening credits. Jim, actually, do you have the explanation about what they taught him?
Because yes.
There's some chilling aspects of that.
Yes, here we are. This is Marcus talking about his Ranger pin.
You know, I was noticing that pin you wear. All the other Rangers wear one just like it, but I don't know what it means.
The two figures on either side, one human, the other Minbari. They blend together in the middle to signify the two halves of our souls uniting against a common enemy.
This jewel?
Minbari call that Izzeltzar, means the future, birth, beginnings, dawn of a new age.
Izzeltzar. I like it.
It's a subtle language for subtle people. Took me a year of studying to get the fundamentals down. The Minbari say the only way to understand the battle is to understand the language. War is as much concept as execution.
What else do they teach you?
Delight, respect, compassion. That for your actions to be pure, they must proceed from direction, determination, patience, and strength. I'm afraid I'm still working on patience. They taught me how to live, how to breathe, how to fight, and how to die. And they taught me terror. How to use it, and how to face it.
I think I'd like to hear more about that.
No, you wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't.
Yeah, that's there is the... Definitely the chilling part. There's more to the Minbari than what you see from Dalin.
Oh, yeah. And the look on his face when he says, no, you wouldn't, you know, that was convincing.
Very. Well, moving on.
Mm-hmm.
We have, what do I call it? A weapons violation? Good word for it.
Yeah.
Question, do you think chainmail would stop a PPG?
No, it would probably make it hurt a lot more.
Well,
I was thinking this would be a neat, if there was a, you know, a bonus side scene video on a DVD or something where you have the guys scanning for the weapons and they see, in my mind, they see this sword-like device. And you would think there'd be that moment where they jibber-jabber back and forth quietly with each other. What is that? That looks like a sword.
Yeah.
No, it can't be a sword. What? Maybe it, you know, that moment of somebody's not really walking onto the station with a sword, right?
Yeah.
But it's a weapons violation.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hardly concealed, though. Oh, okay, it's no. Under his cloak.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty interesting how the scanner can distinguish a sword from a piece of metal and identify it as a weapon.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's got all the characteristics of a knife. It's just big. And now wait a second though. Talon, he carries a sword.
Yeah.
On the station.
Yep. Yeah, so that's not foreign to them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That and how did Talon get it on?
I don't know.
Yeah, and Jakar's got short swords and the like on his wall
too. Right. And so does Londo.
Yeah, he kills kills bugs with it.
Right.
I meant Londo, right.
At any rate.
No, Jakar's got a weapon. Yeah. At any rate.
Yeah, at any rate, the guy that comes on the station appears to be a serious nut job.
Yeah. that's the most practical conclusion when you get someone in security waving a sword around claiming to be Arthur.
Yeah.
Fortunately, Marcus is in the area and has a good concept on how to defuse the situation, mostly.
Marcus behaves very respectfully.
Right. Except he forgets about that little trip to Avalon that Arthur made. You know, Arthur's right. Everyone else is dead.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, very respectful of it.
Yeah.
You know, he almost falls into it so quickly.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much is that his ranger training? Is that his British heritage? Or
I believe the British heritage for one thing, and knowing the story for another, and his training, and, you know, and perhaps some insight. You know, Marcus is is kind of a sensitive kind of person, and we've seen that in the past. We'll see it even more in the future. So, yeah, I think Marcus just assessed the situation and figured out how to defuse it.
And when you say insight, I was going to ask you if you mean just in the defusing or that just that instinct that there's more, there's something more here and I want to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, both. Some of both, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Neat thing is now when we get Arthur explaining what's going on, what's happening, he's not without knowledge of the present.
He's not without knowledge of the present, and at the same time, he's got an excellent grasp of the legend.
Yeah, he's just very delusional.
Mm-hmm. And something, in fact, at this point that we're talking about, he talks about the old wound.
Oh, yeah.
Keep that in mind, because that's a key phrase. Obviously, in the Arthurian legend, it's the stabbing by Mordred.
Right.
But it's a little different. We'll find out in reality what this old wound is.
Well, in at least in this Arthur's reality.
Yeah. But regardless, as you say, he's got a grasp of the legend. He's back because he's needed. And again, that's going to have an interesting take on this version of the legend. Now, bear in mind, there actually is evidence there really was an Arthur.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Oh, I've read that. And if I'm not mistaken, it was actually a Roman commander named Arturus.
That's one of the more prominent,
At least.
And there's claims to have found, though lost, an actual log-based casket that had remains that dated back to the proper time in the 500s, 600s.
Well, most legends have a basis in truth.
Indeed. And, you know, let's face it, we've got the examples before. It kind of matches what the Vorlons would do, right? Except, of course, he's not speaking Old English.
Well, yeah, his English is definitely modern. We wouldn't understand him if he was speaking English from Arthur's time.
Yeah, they exposed us to that in my English Lit class, Chaucer. Not just translations of Chaucer, but showing us the Chaucer in its original Old English. And my copy of Beowulf does the same thing. It's a completely different language.
Yeah, I read Le Morte d'Arthur. I can't even say it anymore, but The Life of Arthur is...
Mallory.
Yes.
He acts like Arthur.
That he does. That he does. When he gets out of Medbay, his checkup there, he doesn't waste any time. He's out and about doing chivalry. Doing chivalry to some really great music as well. And, of course, you have to add in the old dowager. And, of course, at that time, I'm managing to resist any Monty Python comparisons regarding that discussion of the collective.
Well, that's a good thing because...
See, he's oppressing me!
Yeah. Every time someone gets into a discussion about the Monty Python and the Holy Grail, you wind up quoting a lot of Monty Python and the Holy Grail stuff, and we should probably avoid that since this is not the Monty Python and the Holy Grail podcast.
You got it in that time.
Yes.
Oh, God. Well, in that case, let's add Jakar to the mix.
Yeah.
Fair?
Yep.
Yeah, because you know where that has to go. Yeah. Our Arthur, on his way to right the wrongs, finds the creep who stole the poor lady's picture, and the guy points out that he has friends, to which Jakar yells out, "So does he," and dives into the fray.
What an entrance.
Yeah.
All I could think was he didn't mess up a single prosthetic.
Oh, my God. Oh, gosh.
That was a leap.
It was.
It was, indeed.
But, yeah, that was just so darn heroic. I mean.
Yeah. It really was a great piece. It was a fun piece. And the line afterwards, a very satisfying thump when they hit the floor. Oh, gosh. Their conversation afterwards is, you know, warrior born. This is another just great Michael York delivery, if you've got that for us, sir.
I do.
By Sir Quan, I can't recall the last time I was in a fight like that. No moral ambiguity. No hopeless battle against ancient and overwhelming forces. They were the bad guys, as you say. We were the good guys, and they made a very satisfying thump when they hit the floor. It's wrong for the strong to prey on the weak. That idea was at the very heart of the Round Table. To correct injustice. To promote a society of laws, not arms. Well said! That is the purpose which God and the Crown have set before me. I cannot achieve that locked away in some room.
No, of course not. What room?
I sense in you a warrior born, but a priestly manner and refined education. Oh, well. My knights were such men as you. Well, were not exactly such as you. The eyes were not as... it matters not. You were the first to lend your good arm to my defense. And you shall sit at my right hand at the new Round Table. And you shall be known as Sir Jakar, the Red Knight.
Well, two things come to mind off that. One is that is an excellent description of Jakar.
Yeah.
He definitely reads the guy correctly.
The new Jakar.
Yeah, the new Jakar. And it's almost prophetic as far as the whole priestly, I mean, the whole thing along the. But the other part is the degree to which Jakar takes him seriously.
Yeah, Jakar seems to just accept him for who he is, almost the way Marcus did, to defuse the situation when Arthur shows up. Just takes him at face value, doesn't argue with him, doesn't challenge him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jakar's talking to Arthur.
Jakar's talking to Arthur, and he's enjoying every pint of
it. Oh, yeah. And Jakar doesn't even know who Arthur is.
Yeah, he sees a like-minded individual and bonds with him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A person of action.
Right.
Right. And as he said, no ambiguity, no gray areas, the good guys and the bad guys, like he wants it to be.
Yep, much simpler times.
Yeah. Mike, in a break for a little brevity here, is still fighting the post office.
Yeah, after hours.
Yeah. Speaking of a little moral or legal ambiguity here, B&E?
Yeah. Breaking and entering, Mike? Okay. Now, I don't know about you guys, but Mike is the security chief on board the station doing this, I did find this at least a little bit disturbing.
Yeah, but on the flip side, when you consider Mike's roots... Disturbing, yes. Yeah, surprising, not as much.
Well, it's comic relief, I know that. But, exactly. But at the same time, I don't know. I just don't see Mike breaking the law to get his baloney. You know what I mean? Does that postmaster guy sleep under the counter?
He's the only worker in the post office.
Well, he's not there waiting just for Mike to come and break in, is he? I mean, the guy must be sleeping under the counter because he just pops up. And says, now you're going to have to pay for the lock, too.
I almost wonder if he was expecting... It's almost like he was expecting something from Garibaldi.
I guess.
But, yeah, it was a good break. especially with what we come into next. How do I put it? For some reason, Arthur takes his fight against evil. I mean, it's not just acts of chivalry and the delusions. He takes it very, very personally, I guess is a good way of putting it. I think you've got the clip for that. Let's go ahead and hit the clip and then follow up.
Okay.
Do you mind if I ask you a question? Not at all, my good comrade in arms. You seem to take our battle quite personally, as if what they had done offended you.
It did. At Cannonfield, my knights lay dying or dead. As dawn spread across the bloody ground, I saw others moving among them, like specters risen from some unholy grave, stealing their swords there, jewels there, crest there, rings. My knights were there because of me. I was responsible. I was responsible.
Were you all right?
Oh, yes. Yes. It was a dream, that's all. Battle was not intended. With our forces halved, we could not stand against Mordred, so I met with Mordred at Camlan to arrange a truce and buy time for Lancelot to return with reinforcements. We stood there, out in the open. Each of us had 14 knights at his side. Our armies had been told to watch and... attack if someone drew a sword. We just finished our negotiations when one of Mordred's knights saw an adder about to strike, so he drew his sword. The others saw it and... the killing started. It was a misunderstanding. A misinterpretation. See what it cost us.
Now, for those that know how the Battle of the Line went, this is a perfect, perfect description of what happened.
Uh-huh.
But it's almost poetic.
It's, and the, yeah. And you've got two great Shakespearean actors sitting there together with this crazy sci-fi dialogue. And my God, they're selling it. And if you know it, like you said, if you know anything about the Earth-Mimbari War, at that point, your heart's breaking.
Uh-huh. Now, I have to wonder, after watching, you know, the very beginning of this, when Jakar belches, the look on Michael York's face, it looked like he wasn't expecting that at all.
I would absolutely believe you. I would believe it if someone told me. Yeah. And the adder strike, that and a mistake,
mm-hmm,
was a misunderstanding. Yeah, it's like, okay, at this point, it's like, how is all of this connected?
Yeah. Well, as we recall from the Battle of the Line, a Minbari warship came along. Or no, that wasn't the Battle of the Line. That was
That was in the first contact.
Forget everything I said about Battle of the Line. The
Jim. Part of this is a flashback, and that's why I let it go. There is flashback to the Earth-Mimbari War here as well.
Right.
Maybe not in the visuals, but in the reference, and when he's describing the destruction and the death.
Yeah.
That is.
Well, the Minbari ship came on site, on the scene, with the gun ports open.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if we know this. Do we know this yet from other parts of history? Yes, we do, from Narun.
I thought so, yeah. Well, the gun ports open, that, as far as a Minbari warrior cast member is concerned, is a sign of honor, mm-hmm, not a threat. Well, the Earth Force people didn't see it that way. They didn't understand that. They didn't know that. So
right,
you have the gun ports open, a very large, scary-looking ship coming right down
that
your
you've
throat.
You've never seen before.
Yeah, and, you know, it's the whoever was running the guns was ordered to fire.
Yeah. So it's going to start pulling together.
Yes.
Now, there is another, especially in the context, and this is why it took Michael York to play this role, because after that kind of delivery, when Marcus comes in and he makes the comment about calling Sir Gawain the Green Knight,
mm-hmm,
because he can't hold his liquor, just to be able to, like I said, to take that kind of script and sell it so well,
mm-hmm,
was just amazing for me. All right, switching off to the other story, we've got Sheridan addressing the council. And, you know, in a way, it's kind of like he's trying to restore Babylon 5 to its original intent, its original mission,
mm-hmm,
making it a hub for different races in exchange for help in protecting the station.
Mm-hmm.
So...
well, it's needed because,
yep,
because EarthGov is not going to bring forth any support anymore.
No. And he's right. You can't just rely on the Minbari.
Yeah, they have their own stuff going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we kind of get a little bit of sadness in because Franklin has found Arthur's truth. They haven't told us the truth yet, but we've probably, if you hadn't seen it before, you're probably getting an idea of where it's going at this point. And all we hear from Marcus is, you can't tell him this, it'll kill him.
I was surprised. That seemed like a, I'll just say extreme, it's not extreme, but that seemed like an extreme reaction from Marcus to me when I watched this the first time. That it'll kill him.
Hmm.
You know, I kind of sided on Franklin's side as this part of the story unfolded. I guess it matters how it's done, but to me it made sense that Franklin says, or is apparently thinking, we have to We have to help this man understand who he really is, not who he thinks he is.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah. In fact, Franklin said it, or he won't heal, he won't get better.
But is the truth really that important?
That's the question.
Yeah.
That's kind of becomes the question. Marcus is basically, and I tend to agree with JP on this, Marcus is more or less romanticizing the whole concept of Arthur and what he means and what he stands for.
Well, and see, I kind of agree with Marcus. I think it's very sad because that aspect has now been taken away from it. There's no mystery. There's no more wondering. And, you know, the guy started out looking like a nutcase. And by now, he doesn't seem so crazy anymore.
In fact, he seems rather noble.
Yes.
So the flip side of that, the doctor's argument is, what's the harm in letting him be Arthur?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
He's not harming anyone. He's gotten sideways with a couple of thugs down below or wherever he was. But what's the harm?
Yeah. Well, if these thugs are accosting little old ladies, I say turn him loose.
Right. Yeah. And Jakar likes him.
Yeah.
Jakar likes Arthur, not because of the legend.
Get him a security uniform and let him go to work.
I would say Arthur himself is telling us what the harm is. It's what he's repeated several times by this point now.
Yeah.
The old wound,
mm-hmm.
and how the old wound has not healed. And in this case, the truth is that important if there ever is going to be a chance for the wound to heal.
This is the point in the story where his dreams are going to get stitched together with the character that he's become, Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality of what the wound was and what caused it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But his guise as Arthur is acting as a Band-Aid.
Yes.
Right.
But it's a Band-Aid that won't let him heal.
Sometimes a wound needs the open mm-hmm. air. You know, yes, you have to keep the infection out. Yes, sometimes you need the Band-Aid to collect the infection that comes out, but at some point, a wound needs the open air to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, that wound has the name David McIntyre.
Yep.
A war hero from the Battle of the Line.
Yeah, and well, he doesn't think he's a hero.
No, and you know, I've talked to a few people that I would truly call hero who've done heroic things like that. Everyone from my cousin that, you know, had his platoon wiped out to a gentleman that I hired to work for me who literally went into a burning building to shut down a boiler that would have otherwise blown up and killed hundreds of students.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think of themselves as heroes.
No. Well, I, honestly, though, he was ordered to fire the shot that started the Earth-Minbari War. I don't...
Yeah, he was the gunny.
Yeah.
He was the gunny from Prometheus.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call him a hero. Certainly
he's a war survivor.
Yeah, and...
For sure.
And he is a soldier and a warrior who followed orders. And, you know, he was told to do something, and he did it.
Well, it wasn't the acts from the Prometheus that had him considered heroic. It was his stand on the Battle of the Line.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, from the Prometheus, as you said, he was just following orders, and you could tell he was conflicted about that.
Earlier, he had mentioned, what was the phrase he said? We didn't intend to use our weapons. And he's mentioned that everybody was dead. And it makes me think that a part of, you know, some of this may be post-traumatic stress, but some of this could be, when it's all said and done, simple survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
He did the right thing, followed a lawful order, and it resulted in a lot of death. He feels guilty about that, and then he realizes he's still alive.
Yeah.
And, right. And he's now lost in that burden and becomes Arthur to manage it.
And now see the delusional state of him, I would say he has big time PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
I mean, he has built this around himself to stave off the reality.
Right.
And he cannot deal with the truth any longer. So yeah, I think you're both right. Yeah. Survivor's guilt and PTSD, and he just completely shuts down with the struggle of the old wound.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about how he has to return Excalibur to the Lady of the Lake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anyone who's a Babylon 5 fan, and you know where that's going. But at this point, Arthur's catatonic, but we know why now he came to Babylon 5.
Yeah. But, you know, this returning the sword to the Lady of the Lake, and the Lady of the Lake just happens to be who it is just like a huge fountain of irony.
It could be a picture of healing.
A picture of healing and a picture of forgiveness.
Yeah.
Actually, a combination of forgiveness on her part and repentance on his.
An apology or an act of humility.
Yeah.
You know, we had talked earlier about his command of the legend. You know, I'm stretching back a long way to remember it now. But I think it's interesting, and this is a good thing, not a criticism, that he becomes Arthur, who's sort of the pinnacle of a lot, or the focal point of all of this legend. But Arthur, if I remember right, was not the one suffering the old wound. Wasn't that Lancelot? And it wasn't Arthur who returned the sword to the Lady of the Lake. It was Bedivere.
Right.
It was Bedivere.
So he's taken elements of a huge story in his distress and woven them into this character, you know, the kind of the pinnacle character, the prime character, Arthur, but is using all the little pieces of the legend to manage his pain.
Mm.
Though he does talk about Bedivere, you know, sending Bedivere to return Excalibur the three times.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then everything going dark. So he's got the command, but yeah, he's certainly wrapping it up.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't take that as certainly as Michael York or as this character in the show. Not knowing the legend, I thought it was cool that he took all of the parts he needed from the legend to manage or to try to manage the pain. And by the way, even the comment about the Green Knight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And why they called him the Green Knight. Well, Gawain was not the Green Knight, but he attributed calling Gawain the Green Knight when he tipped over like Jakar did. It was Bersalak who's the Green Knight. So, but
right,
quickly you get into a story that's too big to be useful in this story. But I just thought it was real cool, and it goes back to what you said, Raoul. It took somebody like Michael York. Writers can stitch all this together, but that guy pulled it off.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And no, I get it with what you mean with being really cool, and that was the context I got. And yeah, like you said, yeah, it had to be a Michael York. It's like the script was written for
mm-hmm.
him.
Yeah,
that's probably because they couldn't get Richard Burton.
Or Richard Harris.
Yeah.
He has this guilt, right? He mentions the old wound. He talks about returning Excalibur to the Lady of the Lake, and he's catatonic.
And Franklin's not happy, right? Back. The empty room that just jars back, going along with the empty mind.
Yeah.
Now we get a real short break in here, just letting us know that Sheridan got his mutual defense treaty.
Right.
And they don't waste any time at all getting us back to this with us in Medbay and Franklin wondering if Marcus was right. In some ways, the conversation we had a few moments ago.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it looks like that it needs to be thought over for sure because it he's unresponsive. Have we done more damage? Yeah. Than was necessary.
And that's a question that healthcare people ask themselves all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I like the piece about where Marcus is actually working out. In a way, it's almost like they've kind of exchanged roles here. Franklin's beginning to wonder if they shouldn't have told him the truth, and Marcus is now trying to get to the truth of why he came here. Mm-hmm. And I think you've got that clip ready.
Yes, I do.
Marcus's explanation.
What's the story of Sir Bedivere?
Arthur's journey began when the Lady of the Lake gave him Excalibur. As he lay dying, he asked Bedivere to return Excalibur to the Lady of the Lake. The ladies couldn't take him to Avalon, couldn't heal him until this was done. He had to go full circle, right back to where he started.
Now, he said he couldn't know peace or rest until the lady took back Excalibur, the king's burden.
King's pain. That's why he came here. To find someone willing to take away his pain. But if that's Excalibur and you're Bedivere, who's the Lady of the Lake?
Yep, and in walks Delenn.
I wish we could play the clip of that, because it is probably one of the very most powerful scenes in the series, even though it goes on for a couple of minutes. The problem is not a word was spoken. It was just an amazing piece of work by both of them.
Yeah. Did you notice the flashes of green light on the sword?
It was neat.
Yeah. And then now, have you ever watched the movie Excalibur?
Oh, yes.
Okay. All the way through that, whenever there's green showing, it means something good. And I wonder if it wasn't a bit of a callback to Excalibur with that.
I didn't know that. But it almost have to be.
Yeah. Just watch the movie sometime again and notice how often the color green appears, especially when it's reflected in Excalibur in the movie and things like that. Green means good.
And of course, Merlin being a druid, that makes sense. Oh, wow. Now I've got an excuse to watch it again. It's such a long movie. You need an excuse almost, unfortunately. And, you know, to go back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, Delenn being there.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of that scene, her smile of forgiveness just floored you.
Yeah.
Didn't need words.
Yep.
No. And I'm so glad he wrote it that way, because frankly, anything that would have been said would have taken away from the scene.
Yeah. Well, now we get a little bit of a lighten up moment.
You can't go for more drama. So you've got to wrap it up with some humor.
Meanwhile, back at the post office.
Oh, boy. Speaking of another Troy, Heinrichs in this case, Blacklist. The post office wins.
So can you believe it? Mike looks like he's given in.
Yeah, right.
Except that Mikey strikes back.
Well, before that happens, the guy brings up a crate that is all beat up and tore up and stuff like this, and Mike just looks at him. It's like he's not amused a bit with the joke.
I was waiting for him to draw his PPG on that one.
Yeah, the guy says, "Oh, a little postal humor there." I could just see Mike going postal over that.
Yeah. Oh my. Yeah. Well, Mike gets the last laugh. A little bit of a raise in rent prices here. What was it, 100 credits for the package that the guy was trying to charge him?
Yeah, it was 100. It was 100 credits to get his package.
Right. Was that including
Mike
the lock?
Mike came back. For some reason, the lock was completely forgotten in the scene. But Mike turns it around and says, "Well, okay, you know, I'll pay the 100 credits, but, oh, by the way, I'm going to take a 101 credit bribe to not report you for not paying rent.
Mm-hmm. And uses the rationale for the higher rent, or the same rationale that the postman used for the increased cost of the package. It was beautiful.
Poetic justice.
Yep.
You know, and also somewhat lighter, David / Arthur. And, you know, even now that he's back to David and the burden has been lifted from him, it's like some of Arthur has stuck with him because he's going to Narn to help with the resistance. Arthur might not be able to help, but David can help the Narn.
Well, Arthur was always there beneath the surface, and Arthur came back for David when he was needed.
Takes it right back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're going to start a new round table. We're Knights of the Round Table.
No.
I don't want to go there.
It's a good thing I didn't start off our recording countdown as 1, 2, 5.
Yeah, really. Oh, here we go.
Hey, you open the door there.
I like to push the pram a lot. I am the only one in this group that is allowed to sing, by the way, so don't anybody else get any funny ideas.
I second the motion.
Like I said, there's a reason that I'm a sound man. It keeps me away from any open mic.
All right. Well, on a personal note here, I have a recording of my choir singing the national anthem. Now, it's very difficult at the football game. I don't use the band to play the national anthem. I have our choir sing it, and I record it, and then at football games, they use the recording. One night, I'm at the football game. This was a few weeks ago, and they could not find the recording of the national anthem. And someone says, well, the band's got to play it. And I said, the band doesn't have it. We don't play it. We sing it. Well, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? So I ran up to the booth. I grabbed the microphone, ripped my hat off, and started singing the national anthem. Now, I have never sung solo in front of an audience ever.
Can't say that anymore.
And now I've been in choirs. Well, you know what? I did rather well.
Were they all wondering who was that?
Well, you know, it was a knee jerk reaction. But about halfway through, I got as nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs because I'm sitting there thinking, I'm going to forget the words. I'm going to forget the words. I'm going I managed to get through it, but, you know. So, yes, I am, how shall you say, I've been baptized by fire.
Ah, yeah.
So I get to sing. Y'all don't.
I'm okay with this.
Well, I'm good with it. I only use it as a threat.
Yeah, and see, in Raul's case, our audience is grateful for it.
Jim has unfortunately heard me sing, just because he didn't believe it could be that bad.
Yeah.
But
so
we wrap it up with Marcus and Franklin, full circle, as both of you have said. You know, it's not just David McIntyre and the Narn that are holding on to the image of Arthur. Marcus seems to as well.
Yeah. and it's kind of interesting because now as they leave the scene,
right,
Marcus is going down through. Okay. And so Sheridan is this one and Kosh is Merlin and Marcus sees himself as Lancelot. And,
probably not
Franklin
the most promising future there either.
No, you know, and then he leaves with a question: who is Morgan Le Fay? So I thought about that, and let's see, that's Mordred's mother. Could it be the woman from the Night Watch that tried to seduce Sheridan a few episodes ago? Well, you know what? Let's not say it, but I'll tell you what. We're going to find out in episode 21 of this season.
I was just going to ask you that. Do you think we might learn at the end of the season?
And
shadow dancing.
I had never made the connection until you brought this up, but damn it, that is a home run, Jim Arrowood. That is a complete and total home run.
Yeah. Now we have to remember this so we can remind everybody who Morgana is.
Between the three of us, somebody's going to remember.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, there is
an episode our 221. Show. I just made a note on it in my on-screen sticky notes.
Yeah, 321.
Did I say 221?
Yeah.
Did I type 221?
We don't want to go back in time. This is not a time travel podcast.
Once an episode. Oh, this was really a great piece of work. Great cast. You've got these wonderful Shakespearean actors, wonderful stage actors. How can you not give them an opportunity to do a piece of art like this?
Yeah. It is a lighter episode. Overtones. Yeah.
Or undertones.
Serious overtones and fun. So,
but you often find some of the greatest humor in some of the deepest drama.
Yeah. Well, we needed this break because the stuff that has gone before, a few episodes before this one, were really, really heavy.
And don't forget, there's this roller coaster that you call the rest of the season. What do we have next? We have Ship of Tears, Interludes and Examination, War Without End, the two-parter, Walkabout, all the way up to episode 322, which is called Zaha Doom. And it's intense. And it's roller coaster-y.
Yeah. JP, what about you? You have closing thoughts?
I enjoyed this. I could have watched it just for Michael York.
Yeah.
I could go upstairs now and watch it again after this conversation. Yeah. And largely, as you say, for Michael York.
Right.
Yeah. He is one actor that I really enjoy. Another one, Peter O'Toole, is another one that I don't care what he's in. You know, he just takes over.
So between
everything.
This episode and the next, we need to go watch Logan's Run.
And Excalibur.
And Excalibur. And all three Austin Powers
movies. Touche.
To keep it light.
Uh-huh. To keep it light.
Well, as you mentioned, Raul, our next episode is Ship of Tears, the 14th episode of the third season, and Bester's back.
Ah, yes, it is.
I am really interested to hear JP's thoughts on Bester next time.
Oh, we'll make a point. We'll make a point to leave some space for that in our plans.
Uh-huh.
Okay, folks. Any other last thoughts?
No, sir.
Well, did we have any boom today?
Well, not counting the dream, which was, 20 years ago? No, 10 years plus ago.
No boom.
No boom today. There'll be boom tomorrow.
Really?
Really.
There's always boom tomorrow.
Oh, I keep...
Exactly. Listen to
I
the guy.
I keep forgetting that.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.
So long.
Podcast terminated. Thank you for listening to the Babylon Project podcast. You can email Raul and Jim at the Babylon Project podcast at gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook at the Babylon Project podcast. On the internet, we are at babylonprojectpodcast.wordpress.com. To subscribe to the podcast, you can find us on iTunes, or you can subscribe to the RSS feed on the webpage.